Hey, welcome to the 1505 Club. Today's guest needs no introduction. If you've ever watched a chiropractic video on YouTube, then no doubt you have seen one of Dr. Ian Rossborough's videos. Dr. Ian is a very talented and busy chiropractor in Melbourne, Australia. I asked him to join me today to talk to you about the proper care and thought process when we see acute patients. This is something that Dr. Ian has demonstrated masterfully in his videos, but I want you to get a look behind the scenes and inside his mind to understand all the thoughts that go into creating such amazing results. Especially for young practitioners, the acute patient situation is often intimidating and, dare I say it, scary. There's no doubt that the pressure is on and all eyes are on us, looking for us to perform. That's why I thought Dr. Ian would be the perfect person to walk us through this process and help us to elevate our game. So without any further ado, Dr. Ian Rossborough. Hey, Dr. Ian, thank you for joining us today.
You're welcome. Nice to be here.
Could you start off by telling us a little about how you got into chiropractic and more specifically how you got into Gonstead Chiropractic?
Yeah, sure. I'll try and make it quick. Because, you know, a long story short. But essentially, towards the end of secondary school, I knew that I wanted to do something in the area of helping people, but I wasn't sure what. And then it occurred to me one day that I wanted to do search and rescue type things, you know, jumping out of helicopters into the ocean and so on. Everywhere you could do that, you know, the Air Force, the police force, places like that, Navy, they all told me I was colorblind. And so but prior to getting to the point where I could apply, because you had to be 21 at that stage, 21 years old, I'd already started a nursing course. And I started pretty much anything that I thought would help me get in. So I did, you name it. I did advanced diving courses and driving courses and firearms courses. And, you know, I thought I want to give them no reason. They can't knock me back, you know, when the time comes. Anyway, I didn't figure on the colorblindness thing. So I finished nursing and decided to do study medicine because I thought I'd like to do emergency theater. And the reason being the time that I'd spend in the hospital system, without offending anybody, I'd never really seen anyone outside of accident and emergency, like acute presentations, crisis management. I'd never seen anyone outside of those areas actually get well in my time in the hospital. And, you know, somebody might appear to get well. They'd visit a medical ward and they'd be there for anywhere from a week to 6 weeks, 8 weeks. And then, but eventually, if you're there long enough, you'd see these people come back again. And the day that it really dawned on me that I couldn't spend a long time in the hospital waiting to do what I wanted to do was one day I realized the first thing you do as a registered nurse is you go on a drug round. And I realized that two of the pills were for the problem and the other four pills were for the side effects of the first two. So on that day, and then there was a very special patient that taught me a lot. There was this lady, she was only 48 years old, and to take her to the bathroom, we had to put her in a full body Perspex cast, and otherwise her bones would shatter. And, you know, I looked into this and found out that this was 30 years of acute presentation through accident and emergency and getting, you know, high doses of prednisolone for her asthma. And it basically leached all the minerals out of her bones over that time frame. And, you know, I didn't think too much about that other than, you know, it is what it is. One day I was speaking to a group of medical doctors and I told them that I was looking at chiropractic, and they all laughed at me and said, you know, why would you want to do that? And, you know, you should continue and study like medicine like you were going to, because medicine's the only thing that actually fixes anything. And I brought up this patient because two of the people at the table were aware of this lady. They actually looked after her as well on doctor's rounds. And I said, you know, this lady in your mind has been fixed because, you know, in another 48 hours or so, she'll be discharged and you'll consider that fixed. But technically she presented for the first event of this problem 30 years ago. And now 30 years later, she still gets her acute symptoms. And not only that, she can't even get out of bed without her bones breaking. Like, I just don't see that as a success. And So that was when I really thought their definition of fixing someone and mine was very different. And I knew that I couldn't spend 10 years doing that, waiting to become an emergency surgeon. So I started to look for another type of doctor I could be that didn't require, healing from the outside in. Once I got into university, I did every seminar you can imagine. I borrowed some money, and that money was purely to do every seminar that there was, because I wanted to really have a good look at what was out there. I'd seen Gonstead practitioners in the past at myself as a patient, so I believed that that's what chiropractic was. And then when I found out, oh, there's all these other things and they have fancy names and all, I thought, well, you know, maybe I've been missing out. Like maybe what I've been getting is, you know, not the best of the best. So I spent the first 3 years basically checking every technique out that I could. Some of them I did two or three times. No offense to them, but, you know, for the, you know, in the, I guess, you know, to honor honesty, I thought I must have missed something. I mustn't have been listening, because, like, there's a lot of people that practice this thing and they rave about it, and I saw nothing. So I did some of them two or three times, and at the end thought, no, I still see nothing. So I stepped away and from those. But I was very lucky. In first year, I took a bus on a 10-hour drive to a seminar in Sydney here in Australia, and I met the Cox, you know, the GCS group, which is Alex Cox and those guys, and John Cox. And, you know, in the first sort of address in the morning, I was listening to Alex talk, and then he was followed up by I'm sorry, I can't think of his name right now, but anyway, another really prominent Gonstead practitioner. And I was just really touched. I thought, this is the real deal. Like, these guys are true healers and they really know what they're talking about. And you know, when you meet somebody, like they might be a return serviceman or someone, but you meet someone and you just know that they know, you know, they've seen it for real. And that was the feeling I got when I met these people. So I jumped into Gonstead then. I attended every seminar that I possibly could, and I practiced it every day. The guy that I lived with, lucky to be alive. but in the meantime, like in the following few years, I still went out in sort of search of other things, but I just didn't find anything that had the depth or what I perceived as the effectiveness, the balance between effectiveness at assisting to someone find their optimal health and safety. You know, there are a lot of chiropractic techniques that you could argue, you know, have at, like, virtually no risk of any harm. But I, at least the types of patients that I see daily now, I don't believe those techniques would do anything for them.
Yeah. You know, I had a very similar experience. For me, it was the same thing when I heard the Cox brothers talking for the first time. And it was just evident that these are guys who do this every day. They know what they're talking about. And that was unique for me, because even in school and other places like that, I heard of people talking, but it just wasn't so evident that they really, really knew what they were talking about until I heard them. So yeah, for me, that got me hooked. It was like, okay, this is the path for me. And I don't know how long this road is. And I think sometimes if we knew how long the road was, we might not get started, but we start down that road and then you just keep going and going and going and end up a long ways from where you started.
Yeah, well, you know, exactly right. Anyone that asks me for advice, I always say just no matter what it is, just take a step in the right direction. Mm-hmm. And, you know, don't worry about the one after that. If you just move towards your goal, you'll take the next logical step and then eventually you'll be very close to – you'll never be where you want to be, because, you know, as you know, if you're somebody who, like, as soon as you understand an art and as soon as you realize that chiropractic itself, you know, the art component of Gonstead is massive, like, you know, you can learn anatomy and physiology and you can, you know, you can have an understanding of science and you can have an understanding of philosophy. But, and you can get that to a significant level rather quickly, but the art component is a life's work.
Yeah, for sure. Well, one of the things we want to talk, actually the main thing we want to talk about today has to do with seeing acute patients, which is something that I think in the Gonstead world, we see a lot of acute patients. We do that pretty regularly. And I've kind of come to learn that there's a lot of other techniques, most other techniques, don't really have a special way to see that. And it tends to make a lot of practitioners, young and old, get kind of nervous when they see somebody who's in a lot of pain and they're really kind of over the top. And so since we do so much of that, we really want to address that issue of seeing acute patients. So let's start off with the idea of, okay, you're in your office working and that really acute antalgic patient comes in the door. As soon as you see them, are there any thoughts that go on in your head that you start thinking to prepare yourself for what you're going to have to do with that patient?
Yeah, well, I just know that I'm going to fix them. Like that's, you know, that's the first thing. And the reason why that's important is, when I say know it, I don't mean like I'm going to like G myself up, like I'm about to have a fight or something. I actually, in a really calm way, just know that I am going to help this person, at least to some extent. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for anybody who's listening to this who is just fairly new to chiropractic, you know, you might say, oh, well, you know, that's good for you, but how do I do that? Well, the way you do that is you really, really dedicate yourself to the basics right now, like today. And you've got to see yourself as a chiropractor, even if you're a first-year student. You know, you're a chiropractor right now. You're not out of college yet. You haven't got your qualification yet, but you're already a chiropractor, and you've got to think like that. And you've got to dedicate yourself to the really deep fundamentals of the Gonstead system, because when you see a really cute patient walk into your clinic, the assessment that you go through in your mind and later the physical things that you do to the patient, they all come from that basic foundational stuff. And, you know, you need to get really good at finding a PIEX and an ASIN and an L5, and you need to really understand what a film looks like what a subluxation looks like on film. And, you know, before somebody jumps at me for that one, I'm going to say, yes, you find the subluxation on the patient, certainly, and then you refer to the film. But let's just say you've identified that, you know, the L4 disc is the problem. You've still got to determine whether you're going to correct that from above or below the disc. And you've also got to determine whether the disc itself is the problem or the symptom, because the problem may be nowhere near that L4 disc. It could be somewhere else entirely. So the films help you. They help you a lot. And the better you can get at analyzing the films, the more trouble you'll save yourself from and the quicker you'll direct yourself to the primary issue.
Yeah, you know, that's, for me, that's a really hard one to try to teach as a milestone in learning, to try to figure out how to get people there. Because I've seen in your videos, you do something where, in fact, there was one I showed students where I knew that they would think for sure it was an L4 problem, and I knew it was a pelvis. And then when you adjusted the pelvis, they're like, how did you know it was the pelvis, not the L4? And I'm like, how do I guide you in that? How do I teach you that milestone where you start to understand that just because the disc looks bad doesn't mean that's your main subluxation. It could be somewhere else. And understanding the effect that the pelvis has on the discs and things like that. And I don't know, maybe you have some ideas of how you really tone your mind to that.
Yeah, for sure. Look, there's a lot of, I think a lot of that comes from the education. And even in the universities, and definitely in the hospital system, there's a massive over-reliance on MRI and CT images. And, you know, for a surgeon, an MRI showing, let's, you know, we'll stick to the L4 for now. An MRI showing a massive disc bulge at L4, you know, maybe sort of posterior lateral, and it's, you know, it's impeding on the thecal sac, and there's all the evidence in the world medically that that is the thing that's causing the trouble. Well, for that skilled professional who's going to have to, well, in their mind, they think they have to go in there and trim that disc off. The MRI is very useful because it shows where it is and what position it is and all the sort of assist them in terms of their entry point and all that sort of thing. But so for them, it's a diagnosis, but for us, it's just a symptom. That disc bulge is telling us that there's a problem somewhere, but we don't know where yet. And 9 times out of 10, something somewhere is not working, and it's caused that disc to blow out. So if my advice to anyone starting out looking after these acute issues is, yeah, it's a piece of information and you take it in, but step right back before you step in. The other thing is, when it comes to what I said earlier about really understanding the foundational aspects of Gonstead chiropractic, is if you don't know how to, if you don't know how to find a subluxation on someone, say, you know, you would grade it as maybe like a, say, a sprained strain of a sacroiliac joint, and if you had to give sort of a general diagnosis, you would say, look, there's a sprained joint. If you don't know how to list the ilium to the sacrum or the sacrum to the ilium, and you don't know how to actually find the components of what and add them together to the point where, you know, you can make a decision of what to correct, there's no way you're ever going to be able to look after a really acute person, because when someone's really acute, you can't afford to make a mistake. The other thing is, with the importance of the foundational work, is your adjustments have to be really clean. So you have to have seen a lot of patients where you just dedicated every moment of the day to getting a clean correction. And it's never about mobilizing a joint, and it's never about just reducing a fixation. It's always about correcting a dysfunctional segment to a functional segment. And you have to determine what that dysfunctional segment is. And it's not even enough to be on the right bone. It's degrees and millimeters. You have to identify the exact contact point and your exact line of drive and torque. And, you know, all this has to be learnt from the patient's body. So, you know, in the early days when you're seeing people that aren't super acute, but they are presenting with a strain type symptom, if we could, just for the purpose of the podcast, and to make it easy to understand, you never want to approach that patient in terms of, I'm going to mobilize this joint. You've got to identify really, really clearly in your mind exactly what vertebra is subluxated in relation, or what bone is subluxated in relation to what bone. And in your assessment and your palpation, starting with static, like the static palpation is, I think, the most important tool you've got other than visualization. You're gonna feel where the open wedge is. You're gonna feel where the fixation is. And then when you go to set the patient up, the setup itself is gonna teach you where the neutral joint space is. And you, like, degree by degree on the angle and millimeter by millimeter on the pressure, you're gonna feel where that joint starts to open up. And then you wanna make a really artistic, expert type thrust, with having in mind that you really are correcting something to something. And it's only when you've done that for a long time and you've got good at that, that one, patterns that you described before with the L5 and the pelvis correction will start to become more apparent, but also your adjusting will be expert enough that you can give these very specific corrections and take the person towards healing, as opposed to upsetting the problem or increasing the nerve irritation.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent tip, the idea of setting to something and not just moving a bone. Because so often people just think in terms of moving a bone. And no, we're setting it to something. We're going to a target. That's a great tip.
Yeah. So like, even if you had, like, say, for example, you know, you've got someone's decided that it's a PIEX. It could be any example. But, you know, the average person, I think, is going, okay, well, the bone's got to go, it's got to move this way. But it actually, it doesn't actually have to, it only has to move in the way that's going to allow that vertebra to find its way home in relation to the stable, sorry, to the foundational segment. So the, there's a segment that is functional, that's perfectly functional, and you're setting this dysfunctional segment to that. So you've got to find the way that you're going to set that down onto that segment. That's if it's at the SI. It's exactly the same if it's a disc issue. You know, you've got a stable segment below your subluxation, and you're going to set that segment onto the disc. So, yeah, if it's not just moving a bone in a certain direction.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to lead you a little on this question because we're talking about that. Because we're setting to that, stabilization is a huge important part of the adjustment. How much more important is it when they're acute?
Yeah, it's extremely important when they're acute. Basically, with your adjusting, you want to get your adjusting to a point where the only thing that moves is the subluxated segment. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that's got to do with, in the process of the setup, you're trying to find that neutral joint space. You're trying to find that point where the vertebra actually wants to move and the body wants to accept that motion. But because we are setting a dysfunctional segment to a functional segment, that functional segment has to stay functional. I think where chiropractors get into trouble is when, like you perfectly said, they don't stabilize that functional segment well enough, and they actually create a problem at a level there wasn't a problem before. The other thing is, both for the local joint structures and also the neurology, the set and hold is very important.
Mm-hmm.
And if part of that set and hold is to close the dysfunctional segment down onto the functional segment, and basically, even if it's just for a microsection second, but you need to actually, like, basically tell the nervous system and the joint, boom, that's where you need to be. And if in that process you rattle everything above and below the contact, you've told the nervous system and the physiology nothing whatsoever. In fact, you've de-educated the body.
Yeah. I think another really important aspect of the acute patient, and it's something we don't often talk about much with the adjustment, is the timing of the adjustment. And I know you'll know what I mean by that, because I've seen in the videos several times where I can see that the only thing you're waiting for is that perfect time. So can you talk a little bit about how to find, because it's true even on anybody, but more so on the acute patient. Can you talk a little about how to find that perfect moment to get the adjustment?
Yeah. Yeah. So basically the thing that I want to say here is that you're never doing something to a person. You're doing it with them. And so, you know, I try and tell my associates, don't ever think like you're giving someone an adjustment as in you're doing it to them. It's more you're doing it with the person, with the patient. So, and I tell the patient that too. So what I want to, in the setup, you're constantly trying to find that point where you find the neutral joint space, you get the segment in a position where it will actually move, but at the same time, you can't move. You can't do anything until the patient's ready to accept it. And so sometimes you'll need to just find this very relaxed state for what seems like forever. You know, it might only be seconds, or, you know, it could be 30 seconds that you're standing there. But what will happen is there'll be a moment, and it's about a hundredth of a second. But, yeah, there'll be a moment where the person just drops into the process, or they melt into the process, or they, you know, they drop their guard, where their body's actually ready to accept that correction. And in that split second is when you have to correct it. And sometimes, you know, the longer you do this, obviously the better you get at finding that point, that moment. And often it's a surprise to the patient and to yourself that actually went off then, because your nervous system is it's so trained that, you know, you just know the moment. Like as soon as your body feels the moment, that's when it goes. Yeah. Now, there's a few things I'd say to people that are starting out or even have been out for a while, but, you know, they keep coming up against these blocks. Getting an acute patient into a position where they'll actually allow you to adjust them that's one of the greatest challenges. And there's a couple of things that I'd encourage you guys to look at. First of all, it doesn't matter how long it takes to set the patient up, you know, and tell them that. I'd even tell the person, we can stand here all day, you know, there's no hurry. And because the last thing an acute person wants to know is that they're on a time schedule, you know. Yeah. And there's a lot about the psychology of taking care of an acute patient that's extremely important, because part of their pain is pain and the rest is fear.
Mm-hmm.
And the fear comes in many forms. It's not just the fear of something bad's happening to me and nobody knows what it is. It's no one's ever going to be able to fix me. I'm stuck with this forever. I'm done for. My life's over. Like it's that type of fear. So
also what you might do in the process of trying to fix them.
Well, that's right. Because, you know, when you're in that type of pain, they can't even imagine shifting their big toe. Like they imagine moving their big toe and scream in pain because, you know, so there's certain things once you understand, like say, for example, you're going to correct a rotated sacrum. There are certain things that you know are going to make the patient feel more comfortable. So rather than sort of just lay them down and put them in the characteristic position, which is going to just aggravate everything, you want to very intentionally hold the person in a way that they were able to lay onto the bench and even they were surprised that it didn't hurt. So, for example, you might start with them seated. You'll instruct them to take their weight of their upper body and you yourself will sort of take their knees on the lateral side with one hand and brace the ilium and sacroiliac joint even up to L5 and 4 with the opposite hand and basically just help take the whole person as a unit onto the bench, keeping that pressure down on the SI joint across the ilium, the sacrum, and the lower lumbars. And you'll, with the other hand, the right hand in this case, if the head's off to the left, you'll have that knee off the bench. You won't allow it to collapse down and aggravate the sacroiliac joint. And, you know, you just tell them exactly what you're about to do and when you're going to do it. But the main thing you want to do is bring their attention to the fact that they've just had some reduction in pain. And you'll say something like, that doesn't hurt so much like that, does it? And they'll be very surprised. I'll say, no, it's actually a lot better like that. And it'll be the first time that their voice has actually sounded close to normal. So I don't know if there's any midwives out there that are listening to this, but, you know, when someone's having a baby, you can almost tell the stage of labor by the sound that the mum makes. Like, yeah, and as it gets down to that sort of real business end where, like, those kind of really deep, old, in-ground sort of instincts have kicked in and they've started to work, like, the voice will change and then there'll be a point where the voice changes back to something more normal. Well, that happens when you find a way to keep your patient out of pain or get them into what I call a decompression point. So what I always try and do in assessment, palpation, and setup is move the person in a way that it's going to decompress and stabilize what I believe to be the site of nerve irritation. And just that alone gives the person tremendous confidence that they're finally in the room with someone who might be able to fix them. Because one of the biggest causes of fear for an acute patient is that they've seen quite a few people. They all sounded like they knew what they were talking about. They all said they could help. They all said something different. And so in the end, they didn't know who to listen to. But eventually it progressed to the point where they were getting worse, not better. And their interventions were getting stronger and stronger, like stronger medication, opioid drugs, it just, you know, injections into the facets. You know, you might have even had, you know, this person in front of you might have had one or two failed surgeries. So, you know, they don't have lamina anymore. They're gone. So whatever the situation is, everything about the person's history has taught them nobody can fix me. I'm unfixable. So if in your demeanor you're doing something different and in your assessment and your setup for your correction, you're the first person that's actually moved them into a decompressed state where they've actually got some form of benefit, you're already miles closer to being able to fix them. Because what you pointed out yourself, David, about the person needing to be in a position to accept the correction, it's going to be much easier to get them there, to get that 1/100th of a second that you can move the segment, if part of the person's, you know. See, what I need to mention here, and I hope I'm not talking for too long, this topic you literally could do a 12-month course on, right?
Could, yes.
Yeah, so I hope I haven't put anyone to sleep yet. But what I want to say just quickly, because it's jumped into my mind, is when you're talking to any patient, actually, but definitely an acute patient, you're not really talking to the front of their mind. You're talking to their higher self. Like, there's the front of their mind is petrified. The front of their mind has had the experience that it's had in the preceding weeks, months, or 10, could be 20 or 30 years. You know, some people that we're talking about in this podcast, they might be seeing you at the end of a 30 or 40 year merry-go-round, you know, of interventions. And, you know, one day the bottom just fell out of the basket and they were petrified to go back to where they hadn't experienced assistance before. So they've been prepared to come and see you instead, right? So that's another interesting thing. And, you know, I kind of, you can say this with a smile on your face, but these acute patients aren't always in your office because they think you're the best in the world. They're often in your office because they don't trust anyone else and you're the, you know, they might have been referred to you 5 times or 20 times by 20 different people in the preceding 2 years, but they were petrified. They were never going to see a chiropractor. And, you know, often have patients say, oh, I wish you would too. Everybody listening to this would have this happen. Oh, I wish my so-and-so would come and see you, but I just can't get them to come in. And I always say, look, don't worry. Be patient with them, because one day their body will bring them in here. And that's what happens. Because the reason is their brain, the front of mind, is petrified. The ego wants to be comfortable and it wants to be safe. And also, the funny thing about fear is humans, even if they're in a disastrous situation, if they feel like they've got perspective on what their fear is, they're happy to stay in that, in that state, because the fear of what could be over there, that they don't understand, so they can't control that. It's a very funny, or not even funny, it's an extremely interesting component to all this, is fear. So the person's higher self is like their subconscious, if you like. They're really, it's really that you're talking to, because, you know, that's the part of the human that's going to actually allow you to do this eventually. That's the part of the patient that's going to actually give you that 1/100th of a second when it comes time to deliver the adjustment. And It's also the part of the person that's going to decide whether you actually know what you're talking about and whether you're the right person for them. And so, yeah, it's I've tried to summarize a very big concept into a short time frame, but I hope that goes somewhere to towards explaining that.
Yeah, one of the comments I've heard so often from people is you're in the video, when they watch the videos, is your demeanor with people who are obviously in a lot of pain and sometimes they're freaking out and you can see how they are and your demeanor. And I think what you've done a great job is explaining that it's not just you acting within your personality, if that's just how you are, but rather that is an important part of this whole process because it helps get rid of that fear and it helps do the calming. And then even how you position them helps communicate to them that I can help you, because as we talked about before, that adjustment is so hard to make that any advantage you can give yourself to buy a little bit more of a window on that timing is it might be the difference between getting the adjustment and not getting the adjustment. And it really is, that's all part of the whole procedure of what needs to happen.
Definitely. You have to get on the same, look, you know, some people start throwing rocks at the screen in a minute like, oh, Dr. Ian's a hippie, but you really have to get on the same frequency as the patient. If you're not on the same vibration as them, you know, you think about when you walk up to a little toddler, you know, a little 2 or 3, 4 year old child, you tend to get down to them and you say, oh, hello, how are you? Like you're not condescending because you know that there's a spirit that could be, you know, 1,000 times older than you in there, but you do get down on their level. You get down to their frequency and you try and vibe at what frequency they're firing at. And it's the same as one of these very, very acute patients. It's not to say like it's actually the opposite. I don't want anyone to think that you put something on or you kind of fake it. You literally have to try and that's why one of the first things I'll do is put my hand on the person. And quite often when I have my first conversation with the person, I'll actually put my hand on them quite early, like on the back of their shoulder or somewhere like that, because it actually helps gauge where their frequency, what their energy is, and it helps you automatically start to, you know, bring yourself in alignment with them. And what you notice is, like, even when I look at those videos played back, I think, gee, well, I really spoke really slowly for that person, or, you know, I spoke very softly, because your voice has to alter. It automatically alters in tune with the frequency of what the patient's firing at. And being able to get there, because remember I said before, you don't do an adjustment to the person. You make the correction with the person. So you both have to be on the same frequency and you both have to be vibrating at the same frequency in order for you to feel when that person gives you that 1/100th of a second window.
Yeah. Yeah, that is always that trick, that 1/100th of a second window and buying all the advantage you could possibly get. Mm. Let's talk a little about we'll call it the D1 disc, the really swollen disc. Yeah. And that is a disc that is so hard to move. So of course, again, we're trying to buy advantage. So ice can buy us some advantage. Pumping can buy us some advantage. What kind of things do you do? Say that it's super swollen and you just know it's super swollen. What kind of things might you do that might've gotten cut from videos that people didn't see to try to prepare that disc so that it's more capable of accepting what you're about to do?
Yeah. It starts with the first phone call. You know, when somebody calls up the practice, in our practice, an emergency patient is written in yellow on the screen. So on any given day, if you look at my computer in my room, there's lots of yellow. And you know, they just get another yellow, will pop up and pop up. What I'll try and do is say, who took the call for this patient? And when I find out, I'll say to them, did you tell them to put ice on the sorest part of their body? And have you asked them to try and move in any way possible? And, you know, 99 times out of 100, my assistant will say, yes, I did. If not, I'll say, please call them back and tell them that. Tell them that I want them to put 15 minutes of ice each hour and move in any way possible between now and when they get to the office. And so what you've done already is you've started just squishing some fluid out of the disc. And, you know, I tell the, you know, quite often the people will say, oh, no, I can't even get out of bed. You know, we're going to have an ambulance bring us to the practice, or we're going to get whatever, you know, we're going to get someone's coming around to pick me up and whatever. And I always say to them, look, I know this doesn't sound logical, but I want you to just slide feet first onto the ground and you'll be able to do that. And then sort of slowly back yourself off the bed until you're on your all fours and just crawl. And even the crawling action will start to push some fluid out of the disc. And when you feel like you're ready, find some furniture that's solid or a wall if you're able to, and use that to bring yourself to your feet. And if you don't feel comfortable walking, at least just stand in that spot and move. Move in any way possible and, you know, obviously get to the practice as soon as you can. When the person's in the actual room, there's a lot that you can do. Once you understand what the person's problem is, there's a lot you can do without them even realizing that you're doing it. Like, for example, like say somebody's got a, like you say, a D1 disc at L5, and, you know, the problem may not even be at L5, let's just say, for example, it is an L5 segment that you have to correct. Through static palpation, observation, and sort of very gentle initial motion palpation, you'll get an idea where the most space is. You'll get an idea where the least amount of nerve irritation is. You'll get an idea where the wedging is, and you'll get an idea where the neutral joint plane of the disc is, you know, and that's the plane line that you're going to eventually need to set the vertebra in. So you'll be able to palpate the segment in a way that it's actually moving some fluid out of the disc. So you'll start to shift some fluid out and decompress the disc, even in your assessment. And the next thing I'd say is, it's a big mistake that I see people make, is they do a lot of palpation in extension. So for example, you've got somebody, they're sitting in the chair, antalgic, and like you say, they've got a massively swollen D1 disc, and they'll start to try and bring the patient over their contact. And essentially what you're doing there is you're closing down the wedge and you're increasing the most swollen part of the, sorry, you're compressing the most swollen part of the disc, and you're increasing the person's discomfort measurably. And if you remember everything we said about fear, you need to be diminishing the person's fear, because the person's confidence in you is going to rise exponentially in line with the amount that you can either decrease their pain or not increase their pain, and apart from other things. So this is not exactly related to what you said, but I think relevant. If you're going to palpate a segment like that, start from wherever their antalgic position is and move them more into that posture. So for example, if somebody's leaning to the right and they're flexed forward, start your palpation by moving them more to the right and more forward. And then when you want to check extension, bring them only back to where they started and not beyond that. So take your initial motion palpation in that range, because one, that won't increase their pain. Two, it'll show their subconscious mind that you actually know what their problem is, and that's why you're staying away from it. And three, you'll actually be able to squeeze a little bit of fluid out of the disc in that gentle motion. I could keep talking if you want me to.
That was actually going to be my next question, because a lot of times with acute patients, you can't do as much with motion palpation because of their antalgia or whatever is going on. And a lot of people like to rely really heavily on their motion. So when you can't do motion palpation, how do you bring those other components into it to help fill that gap, to know that you're confident about what you're doing when you can't really motion it the way you might want to?
Yeah, look, if I was only allowed to have one assessment tool, it would be static palpation. The most important indicator you've got is edema. Edema is like, you could spend your entire life just becoming an expert in reading edema. And you know, and I rely a lot on edema to tell me where the problem is and what needs to happen and in what order. Like, for example, one of the videos that went viral quite a number of times, and you know, it doesn't matter who posts it, like, it seems to go viral again, is the Moon video. Well, you know, over the 10 days that I adjusted him, if I sit here and think about it, even though it was 6 years ago, I can probably, 1, 2, 3, 4, yeah, there were six different that I can think of sitting here. There were six different sacral contacts in that range of adjusting, because what happens is, especially in the sacrum, I think more so than anywhere else, but in other parts of the spine as well, I think what we miss as students, what we're coming through the university, is we, you know, especially if people look at cadavers or dry spines, they imagine the bone being hard. Mm-hmm. But because we're alive, the bone's are pliable. There's actually motion in the bone. The bone it's an alive tissue. And, you know, as you know, we're 99% empty space. Like, most of it, you know, we've got a few solid components, but the rest is just empty space and fluid. So bones actually do have quite a bit of pliability. And the sacrum comes under a lot of torsion, I believe, in subluxation and in compensation for various aspects. Now, one of the problems with these acute patients is long-term compensations have become primary. So you've got more than one primary lesion or more than one primary subluxation. And sometimes often when you make a correction and you decompress a component of the subluxation in that adjustment, when you reassess, the edema is going to change a little, and the nature of the edema is the focus of the edema, the deepest part of it, it's all going to alter a little bit, and it'll often draw you to a slightly different contact point. So one of the biggest problems that I think people have when they're managing an acute patient is they'll get some level of a response in the first correction. And so they kind of get a bit excited and think, well, great, this is it. I found the problem. And all I've got to do is repeat this a few times and I'll get the person well. Well, actually, most times you've got to alter your contact a little bit each time. And even your depth of correction, your line of correction, it all has to alter nearly every time you do it. And that's the real secret to getting these people better quickly. And so to go back to your question a little bit more in terms of the assessment and motion palpation, the edema, spend lots and lots of time on your edema, because your edema will virtually tell you exactly what your contact point is. And when you kind of work yourself around it, find the deepest point, kind of really settle into that puddle. And then once you're in there, just millimeter by millimeter, just kind of hunt around, you'll find this almost gristly change in the sense of the tissue under your finger. And that's usually going to be the most tender point too. The patient will really let you know there, so you've got to be careful when you get close to it. But if you can kind of push some of the edema out of the way and kind of stabilize that point with your contact finger and then kind of flatten out your hand around the rest of the joint, they'll actually allow you to motion palpate them at that level. But if you just do it cold, if you just do it just simply as the patient presents and you use your normal motion palpation strategy, all you're going to do is put them in more pain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and then from that point, another question would be, so now you've done your assessment, probably used a lot of motion and static palpation and then looked at the x-ray to confirm what you're seeing. Now you need to adjust them. And let's say it's an L5. With an acute patient, how would you decide whether you're going to push it, pull it, knee chest, high low? How do you make a table selection? What factors feed into helping you decide which way is the best way to do that with this patient?
Yeah, a lot of it will be determined by which side the patient can actually lie on. Like it's quite often the case that they prefer to lie on the most acute side or the side of sciatica, but it's not always the case. Like, and there's no super logic to that either. I mean, sometimes, you know what I mean? You're smiling. Yeah.
Like, okay, if you say so.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, this is where it's really important for us not to get too hung up on what we want to do, because, you know, we might say, well, you know, this is a PLI-M, so for me, it's going to be best if you're laying this way and so on. But, you know, if you've expertly assessed the person and you've just spent all this time really getting in touch with their vibration and their frequency and where they're at, and you've managed to get a lot of information off their body in terms of all your visualization and your history. By the way, your history is incredibly important, which we can talk about later. But if you've done all that and you've got the person to a point where you can see that instinctively they've started to think, well, David's going to get, he's going to fix me. I'm in good hands. Like, I actually think I finally found the right guy. You can undo that really quick by saying, I want you to lie this way, this time, exactly like this. And, you know, because essentially you've just created a massive disconnect between where they thought they were with you and how much you knew about them and what you actually do know. So what I'll do before we even get to the bench, like say, for example, it's going to happen on the bench, no doubt. I'll tell them that this is what we're going to do. In a few moments, I'm going to have you laying down and I'm going to use my hand to create a little bit of correction on this vertebra. I never say motion. Motion sounds like their brain's going, you're going to move this? No way. Like, do you know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like, this is staying put. You're not moving this.
Like, I can't even move it. How are you going to move it?
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. So, what I need to know, first of all, is which side do you think you'd be more comfortable lying on? And this is before we've even got off the chair. And because you're giving control to them and you're also allowing them to actually think through the process. But it's also, you know, and it's not trickery, like I think it's very honorable. It's also part of that fluid consent, because at every moment you're telling them what you're going to do and asking them what they think about that. And, you know, are you happy to come over to the bench? Yes, I am. Which side do you think you'd be more comfortable on? Like, imagine that you're going to have to lay down. Oh, I think I'm going to have to lay down on my left side. And you're looking at them thinking, yeah, well, physiologically, that looks like it's going to close down the disc to me. And that should hurt you more. But no, you just let them decide. Mm-hmm. And then, so, you know, are you ready to have a go at that? Yeah, sure. But, you know, you might have to even almost lift them over. You give them time and you support them. It's better if they can get themselves there. But you might have to actually help them quite a lot. But then once they decide which way they're going to go, then you use what you've learned over in the chair and the assessment. And by the way, I keep saying what you've learned in the chair and the assessment. Your assessment starts the moment you walk up to the person, as you know. If when you're busy, you probably won't be in the waiting room when the person walks in the front door. The first time you might see them, they'll be sprawled across four chairs in your waiting room, or, you know, laying on the floor outside your door. But, you know, your assessment starts the first moment you see them sitting. You know, they're leaning across, balanced on one elbow, and their right leg is, you know, propped out straight. You can almost guarantee straight away that their right sacroiliac joint is in a really terrible way, or they've got some, you know, very strong nerve root irritation on that right-hand side, and they're trying to open up, create some space there. So there's information you're getting immediately as soon as you look at the patient. The other thing is you got to look at your patient with all your senses. You'll notice with somebody who's very acute, they'll start to take on quite a strange odor when the cortisol really kicks in. I believe that's what it is. Mm-hmm. But when you start to kind of really hone in on an area, the patient will take on a kind of like a pasty kind of oily perspiration you'll see often when they're very acute, and they'll emit quite a strong odor, like they'll actually smell a lot. And it often happens when you get really close to the primary site of nerve irritation. So that's something else that is a little giveaway that you're getting close as well. It's also a giveaway that, you know, their fear, I guess, that fight or flight mechanism is starting to kick in as well. So, you know, it's really important there to get on their page, see where they're at, and do whatever's appropriate to allay their fears at that point as well.
Mm-hmm.
So getting back to your question, we've got them on the bench. The most important thing is if you've got your patient laying down on a bench and you look down on them, you've got to get rid of any form of what I call C shape. So if the butt's kind of moved towards the back wall and the knees are forward and the shoulders are forward, and the patient, when you look down on them, is kind of in that curved C shape, any form of pressure into any segment of the spine at that level is going to cause pain, because there's literally no chance, there's no way you're going to be able to open up the anterior disc space and find that neutral joint position where you can set the vertebra onto the disc. And in the same way, not that you're going to see this very often in an acute disc situation, but if they were in a C shape the opposite way, where the sort of butt was forward, I mean, you'll almost never see this with the example you gave me of a D1L5 disc. You're most likely going to see their butt out, a loss of the lumbar curve. Basically, they put themselves in a fetal position almost. All right. So our job there is to get, this is hard to explain just in words, but our job there is to get, at the very least, if we can get the sacrum L5, L4, and L3 somewhat neutral, somewhat lined up. So, you know, the bottom leg, we call it straight, but kind of straight in relation to the bent one, if you know what I mean. There'll be a point where the nerve roots may even be starting to tug on the fascia, like the dural tissue is actually getting torsioned, or, you know, you've got actual gross nerve root irritation. They're not going to tolerate you putting them in that perfect position for you, you know. Mm-hmm. By the way, when I say this, David, I know you're already not, but I'm just saying, like, I'm talking to whoever's listening that hasn't seen it before. And so what you want to do at that point, what I try and do is start, it's kind of the opposite to what you would think, but usually I would take a hold of the person's belt or their jeans or something that I can get hold of. It could be the gown if it's a lady, that's closest to the bench. And I'll support their L5, their sacrum, in a certain way with the other hand, and I'll rest their their knee, their bent knee, I'll kind of sneak my knee underneath that and put theirs on top of mine and really try and decompress everything. I open up those joint spaces. And then I'm going to tell the patient what I'm going to do. I'm going to say, I'm going to bring you forward to put this into a better position to correct and also take pressure off the nerves. So, because up until that point, they've associated any movement with intractable pain. Mm-hmm. So it's important you say that this movement that we're going to do is actually going to feel a bit better for you. And that'll get them. And what I'll usually do is, like, just lightly with the pad of my finger, I'll tap the back of their sacrum and I'll say, it's from here that I'm going to give you a little push. And then I'll sort of give a little tug on the front part and I'll say, and it's from here that I'm going to pull you forward. Anything you can do to help me will be good. Are you ready? And then we sort of just move them. Now, I might just move them an inch or so and initially and just check in. How's that? Yeah, that's not too bad. Then I'll take the leg and I'll move that a little bit down and I'll take the upper body and I'll move that a little bit back. And as long as we can get a situation where you can palpate just millimeters and degrees, you can feel that anterior joint space, that L5-S1 disc space open at the front, and you can get a contact on the L5 vertebra where you feel like you've found that neutral joint plane, that's enough. If you can get it there, you'll be able to get a good correction.
Yeah. Yeah, excellent. So then let's go back a step since we discovered this and let's talk a little bit about some of those history things. Because you're right, especially because you've got your motion palpation somewhat obscured from what it might normally be. It's like you got to pull information from where you can, and history is another one of those great places where you can get some information. So what kind of things do you look for in the history that might be clues as to partly what you need to do, but also what you might expect as far as healing time for this patient to get an idea of how often you're going to need to see them?
Yeah, well, so I think one of the problems is from the practitioner point of view, because the patient's very acute, quite often the patient's pain, like that acute pain, it started a short time ago, like usually. You will, as you go further down this path and you see more and more of these people, you know, you're going to have, like I'm sure you do and I do, you'll have many patients where, you know, they've committed to surgery, they're in hospital, they're going to get prepped the next day, and they happen to talk to somebody who knows about you and they say, no, you got to get out of that joint, you got to discharge yourself, at least let, you know, David have a look. Now some people were going to feel like they've gone too far and they won't do that, but there's a good percentage of people that, you know, they're just as scared of the surgery as they are of you. And, you know, you become the lesser of two evils.
Yeah, maybe this is less permanent, so maybe I'll give that a shot.
You know, and people ask me, you know, sometimes you'll get the call from, you have to speak to the person in the hospital. And, you know, this is where it's very difficult to, you know, you've got to find the right thing to say, because you can't undermine another practitioner, like another professional said, look, you need this surgery. But, you know, if you can screen them enough to know that it's not, you know, you're not talking about a quarter equina situation or something like that. You know, in my experience, it's one of those things, you can have surgery anytime, but you can't unhave it. Mm-hmm. Like once it's done, it's done. Now, when, you know, in defense of the surgeons and other people that say, oh, you know, you can't let anybody touch you, you can't let anyone sort of mobilize or manipulate or do any manual treatment to this disc because it, you know, looks like it's been in a car accident or whatever terminology they've used for that patient. That's because they're imagining what they understand of manipulation or mobilization to be, which is, you know, someone's going to shove their shoulder to the bench and their knee to the floor and jump on them. Mm-hmm. And if that's what the patient was going to get in my office, I'd be saying don't have it too, you know. But the person giving them advice, they don't understand that, you know, I'm going to move I'm going to move one vertebra that's dysfunctional onto a dysfunctional disc above a functional segment, maybe 1 millimeter, in a very, very, very specific direction, in a neutral joint space with no rotation whatsoever. And I'm not going to impact on anything in a negative way. And even the disc components are going to move. If they move at all, they're going to move in a direction of decompression. So, like, I think if even the surgeons knew what it was that we were going to do, they'd be a lot more open to it. And mm-hmm. that's probably our profession's fault. We haven't explained ourselves very well over the years. Not, I mean, I don't know how well people are listening to us either. So, you know, we could have, that's a different conversation. anyway, the point is, over time, when you've seen lots of these patients, you become very confident to take virtually anybody in any state, and usually you can help them. And what was the nature of your last question, David, so I don't miss it?
It had to do with the history and what kind
thank you. So yeah, what I was going to say about that is, you know, because the person's been in pain for a few days and it's an acute presentation, the practitioner can make the mistake of thinking, I need to know what's happened in the last few days or what happened leading up to this pain. But in most times, that's actually a very irrelevant time period. You know, somebody might have been, you know, cleaning their teeth and they just dropped to the ground. And now, you know, I know this happens a lot, and I'm sort of, you know, my pace is breaking up here because I don't want to offend anybody. But you got to be very careful that you don't think that the person actually put their back out cleaning their teeth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and because, you know, a lot of practitioners will say, oh yes, you know, that 10 degrees of flexion, you know, over the base, and that's the worst, you know, angle for the disc, and blah blah blah. No. If your disc was functioning well and you weren't subluxated, you could clean your teeth standing on your head.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So the history, you can't go back far enough. You know, this acute situation that you're dealing with right now, you know, this could be a 50-year-old lady. This might have started when she was 5 years old and fell on her bottom on the ice, you know. She upset her second or third sacral segment. Her sacrum didn't form properly from that day on. It changed the mechanics of the entire lumbar sacral pelvis. And, you know, the curves were altered, the stress through the discs were altered. And then she lived her life like that. You know, she did sport as a teenager. She eventually possibly had some children. She had two or three pregnancies, two or three deliveries, and then she brought up two or three children to adulthood with everything in front of her body, you know, breastfeeding, babies in the car, out of the car, change tables, bassinets. And, you know, this thing that we're looking at, this blown out L5 disc, that's the end of that story. That's like, that happened as a consequence of all that. So if you can get back, if you can really delve into the person's history, and you've got to do it in a very intelligent way, because when somebody's in intractable pain, it's very easy to make them frustrated. It's very easy to have them lose faith in you. And if you take one of those, you know, crazy long-winded histories that they teach you in university, you know, they're done with you way before. You're not even going to get to the end of it. You know, you'd be lucky to get out of there without a smack in the mouth. But an exhaustive history all the same, but in an intelligent way that doesn't, you've got to be careful not to say, okay, this is a really important point. People in acute intractable pain don't have much energy. So anything that you do to steal their energy is one, making an enemy of you, but it's also telling their higher consciousness that you actually don't know what you're doing, because if you did, you wouldn't be wasting my energy like this. It'd be like powering up to a drowning person in your motorboat and saying, look, I'm going to get you in here, but I just want to ask you a few things. What's your name and address? Any previous locations? Where did you live before this address? You know.
How did you end up in the water?
How did you end up in the water? Yeah. Like, they don't, you know, you're stealing their power at that point. So you've become a bigger problem than the problem they originally had.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to find a way to get this history in a way that doesn't steal their power. So, you know, what I would do, for example, is I'd say, David, right now you feel like you're stuck with this forever, don't you? Oh, yes. You know, that's how you're going to feel, but you're not. You're not stuck with this forever. I'm going to help you, but in order to help you, I need to know some things. Don't feel like you need to answer me straight away. There's nothing more important that it can't wait for a breath. So I'm happy just to wait for you to be in a position where you can give me the words. And just nod if you like. You don't even have to speak. And so you've already acknowledged to them that, and I say to them, you know, your energy right now is really precious. So I'm going to try not to steal any of it. I really need to know some things though. Now, you've got to start with what you've figured out though. You don't want to get all the information off the person. It's a bit like that drowning person scenario. Like you said, how did you get here? What were you doing before you got in the water? You know, what were the steps leading up to you getting in the boat that you fell out of and all that? You're just going nowhere fast. To use that analogy, you would say, well, somehow you've ended up in this water. We've got to get you out. And so, boom, that's good. We're friends, you know. Mm-hmm. And so what I would do is I'd say, I saw you sitting out there and you were leaning in a certain posture. And first of all, are you happier to sit or to stand? And they might say, oh, no, I need to sit. So great, sit down. By the way, they're sitting, you know, they might be leaning completely to the left-hand side with their right legs stuck out straight. What I would do is I'd move something to their left side so that they could lean on it. And I'd say, you're going to need to support this because you've got a swollen disc on this right-hand side. And every time you try and move to the right, it pushes on the disc and irritates the nerve. And they're like, oh, yeah, oh, is that what happens? Oh, right. So all of a sudden you've told them something. And then you're going to brace them on the left-hand side. And you say, I'm just going to brace you here because this is by me bracing you here, it's going to be easier for you to keep the pressure off this side where the nerve irritation is. And they'll be like, oh, that does feel good. All right. Now I might touch them on the right side, sort of underneath the buttocks or on the ischial tuberosity and say, see how you don't want to put this down. And the reason you don't want to put this down is because you've got a big swollen disc right at this point here. This is where the swelling is. And I just put it just a bit of gentle pressure. And they're like, you're telling them that you know what their problem is, right? And by telling them all that, you're not stealing any energy off them. They're not having to use their brain or think or go into the past. So then you offer it to them and say, if you haven't done anything in the last few days to cause this, like you haven't fallen off something or got hit by a car or lifted something very heavy, this most likely happened a long time ago, or this could have happened a long time ago. Do you ever remember? And you, for example, that one I gave you before where the lady fell on her bottom and so on, I would sort of hunt around and find that ruler Demeter's point and just tell them, when I find this spot, it's going to be quite tender, but I'm not going to push hard because I don't want to hurt you. Is that tender there? And they'll be like, oh, yes, yes, yes. All right. Okay. Well, this looks like an old problem. This looks like something you've done many years ago. It looks like you've fallen on your bottom. It could have even been when you were very young. In fact, it most likely was when you were very young because these segments, they're separated by a cartilage plate when you're young, but when you're older, they're fused. Do you remember when you were younger, did you ever fall on your bottom very hard? And they're like, oh, my God, yes. And, you know, and I'd say to them, you know, you could have been like 8 to 12 years old. And they'll say, yeah, I was 8. I fell on my bottom on the ice. Like I'd never forget about it, you know. And so you've done multiple things there. First of all, you've taken them very quickly to the point in history where something happened. You've also figured something out without them having told you. And you've also been able to brace their body in a way that actually gives them some relief. So they're already under care before you've adjusted them. And the most important thing is you've given them some energy now. They have confidence that everything they say to you is actually going to be useful. So then they'll start to say, oh, and then there was another time and blah, blah, blah. And then there was another time. And then, actually about 4 weeks ago, I also lifted a, cut whatever they did, lifted a heavy pot plant or something. And you just kind of extract all this information out of the person and you create a situation where they've actually got the energy to give it to you. But, if you walked up to someone at the end of a marathon and said, look, have you got a moment to answer my 120 questions? They'd just punch you in the nose.
Nope. Yeah. Yeah, that is an important, it seems so obvious, but you're right. I think a lot of times we miss that, how important that is to recognize that they don't have a lot of energy and you don't want to steal that from them. So you got to
You can't steal their power. It's a very important thing. The other thing is, if you're going to find the real source of this subluxation, you most times are going to be looking in a different place to where the main pain is or the main nerve irritation is. So it's any kind of history is, going back any amount of time is going to help you.
Yeah, definitely. Well, thank you so much for joining us. I feel like this is like an excellent primer on how to see acute patients. You covered every stone I could think of and overturned some that I didn't even think of. So thank you so much for joining us and giving people this kind of insight. I really appreciate
it. That's my pleasure, David. We're part of an amazing profession. And, the more good people that we can get, motivated enough and prepared to actually dedicate their life to this, it's going to be good for the world and good for the practitioner themselves.
Yes, excellent. Thank you so much again.
Once again, I'd like to thank Dr. Ian Rossborough for taking time out of his very busy schedule to join us today. I trust you gained some valuable insight from him today, and with that should come the confidence you need to see these types of patients. After recording, Dr. Ian and I talked about the value of the community, specifically the Gonstead community. If you've never experienced the value of the Gonstead community, I would encourage you to begin making plans to join us for the Gonstead Extravaganza. This seminar is a joint seminar with GMI and the Gonstead Clinical Study Society. This year's extravaganza will take place July 24th and 25th at the Gonstead Clinic in Mount Horeb, Wisconsin. While the seminar is a knee chest seminar, there will be numerous pit classes covering a wide range of topics for the more experienced practitioners. If you're a chiropractor or a student, we invite you to join us for this incredible learning experience. I also want to take a moment to thank everyone who's given us a review online. The time that you've taken to do that means everything to me, but it also helps us to improve our rankings so we can bring this message to more people who need to hear it. If you like what you hear and you can spare a moment, we would love it if you could give us a review and help us out. As always, I hope you have the very best week possible, and I'll see you again next time.